a meeting this evening on the historical on an historical subject. Basically, what I'm going to do is talk about the general political and social situation in 1905, while Darren will concentrate on what the party was doing and what the other working class movements were up to. So, I mean, 121 years seems a long time, and in one sense it is, but in another sense it isn't. I mean, I don't think I'm the only person here whose grandfather would have been alive at that time and probably an adult and able to vote. But if you look at it from another angle, 120 years before 1905 would be 1785, which was, I mean, the elite were still walking around wearing wigs. The Industrial Revolution had just about begun, and the French Revolution hadn't happened. The American Revolution had. Or if you want to look at it in another way, in 1905, when the party was 1 year old, Engels had been dead only 10 years, and Marx only 22 years. If we assume we're now in today was 1905, that would have meant that Engels would have died in 2015 and Marx in 2003. So I mean it's fairly near to the founders, if you like, of scientific socialism. I think it's, I know 1900 is just an artificial break, but I think it did represent some real things. I mean, after all, Queen Victoria, she had died in 1901, and the Marquess of Salisbury, you know, Lord Salisbury, had given up being the Prime Minister in 1902, and he was the last Prime Minister to come to be a member of the House of Lords and Prime Minister. So it did, in a sense, represent the end of an era. And Darren and me had to sort of put the stuff onto the internet and onto his blog. We've had to read all the standards. Well, up until 1933, actually. But I mean, it also involved, you know, reading the standards of the period we're talking about, and it doesn't seem alien. Even the photographs of the party members don't seem all that alien. I mean, if you see photographs of people in Victorian times, they've all got big beards. There are quite a few of the people in that photograph of the 1905 conference are clean shaven, and there were other things that. Are familiar to us, if you like. I mean, there was the telephone had been invented, the motor car had been invented, even though they were only open to the elite. There was the beginning of radio and of films, underground of airplanes and so on. But I think the main thing is that I think it's a point that Bartrop made in his in the monument that. This was the first generation of workers that had been educated under the Education Act of 1870. So the people there were the workers there were and the founding members of the party were literate and they wrote in a different style, for instance, from William Morris and people like that. So it seemed to be near to us. And also, of course, the arguments that they put forward were basically the same as we put forward today, so we can understand and relate to what they're saying. Now, the general political situation in 1905, in June 1905, there was a lame duck Tory ministry under Alfred Balfour, who was in fact the nephew of Lord Salisbury, so he was still an aristocrat, but an aristocrat with nothing else to do except going to politics. And he is, of course, the same person who signed, or when he was foreign minister during the First World War, the infamous or the notorious Balfour Declaration that Britain would give the part of Palestine as a home, you know, for the Jews in order to get their support against Turkey during the First World War. And of course, we're seeing today one of the consequences of that. Now, to go to the... there was, I think, one Labour MP, and that was Keir Hardie. In the end, before the end of the... before the end of the year 1905, the Tory administration, which had been in not for 14 years, but for 10 years, collapsed. They lost the vote in the House of Commons, and the Liberal Campbell Bannerman took over as the Prime Minister, and they called an election in 1906. Won, but I think that'll be something that election and what led up to it will be something that Darren will be talking about. But going through what was in the actual issue of June 1905, the first article is called "How Liberals Win Elections," and by pure coincidence, it's not about the Liberals in England; it's about the Liberals in Canada. It's about as I say, it's just a coincidence that we've had an election in Canada, which was won by the Liberals, and there was one going on in Canada at the time. But there was a scandal which I can't resist reading, and that is an accusation of ballot stuffing. This is what the article says. The Ontario ballot boxes were most ingenious. They were provided with a double side and a trap door. With the connivance of a deputy returning officer, some of them were substituted for the official boxes. Before the polling began, they were loaded with votes concealed in the double side and marked in favour of the Liberal candidates. The ballots were marked in the names of men known to be Tories. And when these Tories came to vote, their votes, by means of the spring, were thrown into the false side of the box in place of the concealed ballots, which were then passed through the trapdoor into the ballot box. I mean, it's a pretty ingenious way of rigging an election. Incidentally, the Conservatives in Canada are still also known sometimes as Tories. But the there are two other articles I wanted to talk about. One of them is a book review by Keir Hardie on, it's called The Citizenship of Women, in which he's arguing in favour of a bill which was called the Limited Franchise for Women Bill. And his argument was that you should do this gradually. You should get men used to women voting and voting for women. Once they got used to this, you could extend it further. And of course, the argument in the review is that this is his approach, to socialism too, because he believed that socialism would come like a thief in the night. People wouldn't know what was happening. But in fact, I mean, this raises another point. In 1905, you couldn't call Britain a democracy, not even a bourgeois democracy, because no women had a vote for Parliament, and one third of men didn't. But it was still a political structure where Parliament controlled the executive, even though Parliament wasn't elected by universal suffrage. I mean, the party took the view that enough workers did have the vote. If they were socialists, they could win control of Parliament, and so gain control of political power and introduce socialism. I mean, looking back today, we could probably say this was a rather cavalier attitude to take, but you should remember that the early members of the party, especially in 1905, thought they were part of a worldwide socialist movement as the left wing of the international, you know, social democratic parties, and that they would probably see socialism established in their life. Well, at least they thought this was the most urgent issue, and it wasn't worth diverting from it to get relatively minor from that point of view, partial reforms. But the point was that you can't describe Britain as a democracy, as I say, even a bourgeois democracy in 1905, even if sufficient workers did have the vote to kick the capitalists out. But the article I want to concentrate on is one on page 6, which is called Alien Humbug. And at this time, there was a bill going through Parliament called the Aliens Bill. And I mean, this has exact parallel and relevance to today. This was a bill to keep what I call aliens, what Enoch Powell and Sir Keir Starmer call strangers. It's a bill to keep them out, and the background is that due to oppression and pogroms in the Russian Empire, Jews from that part of the world were fleeing westwards to Western Europe, and then on to America, and a lot of them had settled in the East End of London. Some members of the Conservative Party decided that they were going to exploit that, and one of them was called Major Evans Gordon. He was elected the Conservative MP for Stepney in the 1901 general election on an anti-alien ticket, and they formed an organisation called the British Brothers League, which was campaigning for the legislation to keep out immigrants. But actually, from what he was reported as saying, he was fairly moderate compared with Reform, Farage, Enoch Powell, and Keir Starmer. I mean, here's a couple of quotes from him. A storm is brewing, which, if it is allowed to burst, will have deplorable results. And then, not a day passes, but English families are turned out to make way for foreign invaders. The rates are burdened with the education of thousands of foreign children. So, I mean, this has an exact parallel today with politicians making exactly the same points. The article in the Standard deals with the argument that keeping aliens out would reduce unemployment. It points out that unemployment has got nothing to do with people coming in. It's got something to do with the way the capitalist system works and whether there are or not there are aliens in inverted commas, coming into Britain, it doesn't make any difference. So that's a couple of things which are still shows that we can understand what the political context is and what the political debates were that were going on at that time. Now I don't know whether Darren is here yet, but if not, I'll have to keep talking. Are you there, Darren?
Yes, I am.
So do you want to take over and talk about what the party was doing in 1905, and also about what was happening in the broader working class movement?
I thought you were doing so well that I was hoping you'd carry on for another 20 minutes. I can give some background. I don't think it's going to be as detailed as your introduction, but I'll try my best. Do you want me to take over, or do you want to speak for a few more minutes?
Well, I'll only speak to say that both my grandfather had the vote in 1905, but in theory could have joined the party, but for various reasons didn't. But that's all. So if you want to take over.
Sure. As Adam mentioned, you know, my part of the meeting is just to maybe just give some background and where the party was in June 1905, how it was relating to politics in general in Britain with the left, the capitalist left, and then just open up to discussion. As Adams mentions, the June 1905 standards, you know, just to give some context, you know, that was issue 10 of the socialist standards. We're now up to 1450, as is this month. The party had obviously been formed a year before. The standards had been first published in September 1904. At that time, the party didn't have its own head office. It was still meeting at the Communist Club in central London. So I guess what's now known as maybe Soho. If people in the meeting, probably some people in the meeting will know the famous picture in party terms of the first party conference in 1905. I believe it was published in the centenary issue of the Standard of party members. That was the Communist Club. That's where its first annual conference was held in late April 1905. Those of you who know Keith Scholey, an ex-member of the party, he actually wrote an excellent pamphlet a number of years ago on the Communist Club that you could probably find online, which was published by Past Tense. You know, it's fascinating, like, window into the history of, like, radical London from, like, the late 19th century up until the early 20th century. At the time in 1905, the General Secretary of the SPGB was an Irishman called Con Lane, who's again mentioned in the centenary issue in 1904 as some, like, notorious members. It's kind of interesting looking at the early standards that Lane, obviously a very charismatic speaker and character, there's definitely a case that even though the party from its very, you know, the very outset of its formation was adamant that it was a democratic organization, you can definitely see there was far more sort of articles in the name of the General Secretary, i.e. Con Lehane, in the early standards. I am not saying that was deliberate on Lehane's part, but, you know, you definitely, if you didn't know the history of the party and you were, like, looking at the early standards, you might get the impression that this was, like, you know, like, the first among equals, so to speak. June 1905, according to the standards, the party had 14 branches, as well as central branch. All of them were still in London, Greater London. You know, the Watford was probably, like, the outlier. You know, the party's roots, you know, was obviously in a revolt within the SDF and the London branches. And it was still very much the case that it was concentrated in London, even though there was definitely contact with individuals outside London, especially Nottingham and in Manchester, which you would see within a couple of years, those branches being formed. It was definitely the case that this was still very much a London phenomenon. You're only talking about, like, 9 months after the formation, sorry, a year after the formation of the party. I kind of tried to guesstimate the membership of the party in June 1905, looking at membership records, which are not exact. You know, there's large gaps. But my guess is by June 1905, there was maybe like 220 members. The party was formed with about 140 members. There was a guy called S. Riches of Romford Branch, who was enrolled as a member June 9th, 1905. So that's my guesstimate of the membership. They'd obviously maybe lost a handful of members between that period, between June 1904 and 1905. But, you know, as I could mention, and I could go into more detail if people want to talk about it, in June 1905, there had yet to be any major splits in the party. You know, there was signs, so to speak. You know, you could say that there was things happening on the horizon, which could have led to the eventual splits, but there had been no splits. You know, a couple of members had dropped out. One member had been expelled in that period, a man called Horace Hawkins, who was the brother-in-law of T.A. Jackson, and he was expelled for harassing another party member called Alex Anderson. But there'd been no major splits in the party, so it was still a pretty happy ship, so to speak. Of those 14 branches, from reading sort of party notes, which were really excellently reported in the standards in this period, it's kind of obvious that the major branches were Battersea in South London, Islington and Tottenham in North London. Battersea was the area where I don't know if there was a higher concentration of party members, but that's where, outside of like head office, you know, conferences held in central London, that's where they would hold the mass public meetings, indoor public meetings, the commune meeting that they would hold for many years after its formation, the sort of public lectures where the party would get, you know, substantial audiences for indoor meetings. What has to be obviously borne in mind, and this was apparent for many decades of the early party history, is that the party didn't have a lot of money. So it wasn't really the case that they could actually hire, you know, indoor halls, you know. So to actually hire an indoor hall, they had to sort of know that they were going to get an audience and it was worthwhile. And Battersea was definitely one of the places where they felt that they had, you know, an audience. And with regards to Islington and Tottenham, that was where the party was more reliant in this period for its propaganda, which was the outdoor meeting. You know, it was the era, you know, of not just Speaker's Corner at Hyde Park. You know, there was many sort of public speaking stations all over London, and no doubt in the provinces as well, other major cities, but substantially in London. So, for example, the June Standard of 1905, there's like a wee box in the back which gives you the list and, you know, of the speaking stations in London where the party was speaking and the times and the days. And, you know, at that time, and this was still early doors for the party, it was like 17 speaking stations. The party was speaking on the outdoor platform 6 days a week. There was somewhere in the region of 18 to 20 public speakers, including such names from the party history as Jack Fitzgerald, Jack Kent, Con Lehane, as mentioned, T.A. Jackson, F.C. Watts, Alex Anderson, E.G.B. Allen. And with regards to Islington and Tottenham, there was actually like, there would be like public debates held outdoors with parliamentary candidates. So I can't remember if it's specific to this issue or just before or after, maybe near the July issue, there's an extensive report where the party was so kind of making a noise in North London and Islington especially, that Percy Alden, who was the progressive candidate, parliamentary candidate in that constituency, felt obliged to actually debate the party at an outdoor meeting. And he debated Alex Anderson during this period. And those people who remember The Monument, Baltrop's book, by common consent, Alex Anderson was one of the great outdoor speakers, you know, of this period, when outdoor speaking was such a significant part of political activity and debate, you know. And that's not just socialists saying that. That is something that's kind of acknowledged by people who are quite vehemently opposed to the SPGB, that Alex Anderson, alongside Tony Turner in the 30s and 40s, were just outstanding public speakers, you know, on a par with who we are now told are great public speakers, are led to believe by historians. June was kind of significant, or May and June were significant in party propaganda terms, because it was considered the start of the outdoor propaganda season. As mentioned before, the party was kind of a wee bit of a hermit without, you know, no fault of its own during the winter months, where, you know, its party propaganda could possibly not be as strong as it would like, because, you know, weather dictated that people wouldn't crowd around outdoor meetings. They couldn't afford necessarily to hold indoor meetings to the best of their ability. So as mentioned, you know, that May, June was the time when the party was like gearing up for, you know, more activity in the coming summer months, you know, weather permitting. And just as an aside, T.A. Jackson was actually the lecture secretary at that time. He was the one who was like, I guess, a bit like a central organizer today, like trying to organize, you know, speakers, etc. Arguably, you know, like significant, you know, like touching upon like activity in the party. I wanted to maybe go back a month because I think what's interesting in the early history of the party and such touches upon what I was saying about possible potential disputes within the party is that the May 1905 standard, which is on the party website, on, you know, my blog, and really recommend people look through it because it's fascinating history. There's an extensive report of that first annual conference that I mentioned at the Communist Club. And what is interesting is the three main subjects of discussion. I'll leave the most contentious one last, but the first two, which are of interest, and was you know, the familiarity of the discussion of whether or not the party should contest elections, because obviously we're gearing up for a general election, like Adam said, which was going to come like the following, you know, January the following year. So there was obviously this debate about whether or not the party would contest elections and whether it be contesting parliamentary elections and or local elections. And I thought it was an interesting quote from Fitzgerald talking about, before that, I mean, basically the party then as now basically saw contesting elections in propaganda terms. You know, they recognized even then, even though they definitely were more optimistic than we are in 2025 about the potential for socialist growth, even then there was an acknowledgement that, you know, perhaps they would not be getting socialist candidates elected in the near future. But what was interesting, to quote from Fitzgerald regarding contesting local elections and whether or not a socialist councillor could be that effective. And I'm just going to read it. It's like a paragraph because I just think it's just maybe something that people don't know about the party from the early days. You know, here's quote: "The local bodies were very limited in their powers, and the socialist position should be laid down clearly, pointing out that even with the majority in power, much could not be done. The capture of a municipality would, however, be a means of educating the other municipalities. Money should be voted for all possible purposes in the interests of the working class, and the wages of the municipal employees raised as high as possible. But no doubt the ruling authorities, that's obviously the central state, would come down on the municipality, and some of its members, i.e. party members, would be imprisoned." You know, I thought that was kind of funny, because obviously that's, when I read that just recently, that I guess that made me think about the militant tendency in Liverpool in the 1980s. The second item for discussion, which I thought was interesting, which kind of colours the party's position at the time, was the party was discussing the Second International, the internet, you know, as Adam touched upon. When the party had formed the previous year, one of the first things it did as a party was raise some funds to send two party members as delegates to the Second International, which I believe was held in Amsterdam. It was Jack Kent and I think it was Alex Pearson. And they kind of came back with a very kind of, for want of a better expression, pissed off view of the Second International, primarily because the organizations were like organized nationally. And basically, they understandably objected to having to sit alongside the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, and the Social Democratic Federation, which they just split from. And they obviously were like of the view that, you know, how can you have a proper socialist international when you have reformists within its ranks who would vote for pious class war resolutions whilst abroad, but you'd sit there knowing that they would actually come back in this case the ILP to Britain and actually not actually abide by them. But I think that there's a kind of there's a belief within the party that that was like that was the first and last attitude, you know, interaction the party had with the Second International, that it kind of, you know, to borrow an accusation that leveled at the party about the Russian Revolution, that they basically denounced the Second International within hours of attending it. That really wasn't the case. You know, this conference, they were discussing the practicalities of having an international movement where they recognised themselves as a minority, but recognised there was other minorities within the international, and how could they be able to like rectify that, push back the sort of reformism which was permeating more and more within the Second International, as groups within the Second International were getting closer to political office. And there was sort of practical discussions about what they could do and what they should do to try and sort of, you know, correct things. And it was, you know, obviously it was to try and sort of get sort of like-minded groups, even groups within political parties, to basically like support, maybe possibly support resolutions to try and sort of make it more socialist. And that was 1905, and that was a position they would continue. They were still discussing that until 1907, because international conferences of the Second International were held every 3 years. But by the time of the 1907 conference in Stuttgart, the party was kind of to the point where it was like, yeah, we don't think the international is worth sort of applying too much energy to. The third item for discussion, and I know I'm talking too much, so I'll try and sort of cut it down a wee bit, but it was on the issue of the party's attitude towards trade unions. E.G.B. Allen, who was a founder member of the party, or sort of writer and speaker for the party, he attempted to introduce a resolution at the first annual conference to commit the party to, if not an anti-union position, because he took the view that unions were like embedded within capitalism at this point, or embed, you know, a supporting of you know, non-socialist organizations like the Labour Party, but to even adopt a socialist industrial unionist position, similar to the Deleonists, the SLP that had been formed in Scotland in 1903, and obviously the parent body in America, led by Daniel Deleon. There's quite an extensive discussion of this reported in the May Standard, and people who know the Standard from the Edwardian period will know that this became like a live debate, probably the first major dispute within the party, ideological dispute. But that was just, if you like, the start of what would eventually lead to the first splits in the party, where industrial unionists and Beckley branch split, and then there was a split. The Islington branch disputed party democracy. This was coming up, and then like maybe a year, 2 years afterwards. Okay, moving on. I think another thing that should be mentioned about June 12th, 1905, is it's actually the date of the first party pamphlet. Obviously, there was a significance there. The party issued a manifesto, which is available on the party website. The transcript, it was signed in the name of the executive committee of the SPGB. And it's quite a short pamphlet. It's, you know, you can probably read it in like 40 minutes. And the first part just gives you the historical context of historical development of capitalism, sort of points facts and figures to the income and class inequality that existed not just in Edwardian England or Edwardian Britain, but also in other advanced capitalist classes, like the United States. They quote that, drawing a contrast between the craftsman, the artisan that lived in like 13th and 14th century Britain, or how little work they had to do to sustain themselves and how they owned their tools, etc., and contrasted that with the modern day wage slave of 1905. And as I mentioned, when I mentioned the wealth disparity, they then went on to, in keeping with the party's hostility clause, they obviously felt the need to, in this manifesto, to restate its position, its opposition to other supposedly socialist organizations, and why they'd obviously explaining why they'd formed as a party, they'd taken this step. So they obviously go into the business of the Social Democratic Federation, the party that they had split from, and how, and they mentioned in this pamphlet, they feel that as the ILP was growing, ILP was formed in 1893, and and how it was potentially going to win electoral seats. I think they're arguing that the SDF leadership, and this is part of the issue, the leadership basically thought they were losing out. They basically thought that they were the people who were going to be the first socialists in inverted commas in Parliament. And as a consequence, they were diluting their platform, issuing sort of support for palliatives, reform, limited reforms as a means to vote catching, so to speak. They'd obviously signed up initially the SDF for the Labour Representation Committee in 1900, but there was obviously a dispute within the SDF, within probably people like Fitzgerald and Lahan, actually, who probably objected to socialists being in a non-socialist organisation. And by 1901, they disaffiliated formally from the Labour Representation Committee. But despite that, there were still these kind of backroom deals taking place between leading SDFers and both the ILP and even some liberals to say, well, if you stand there, we won't stand there, and if you won't stand there, you'll allow our court candidate a free run. And there's examples of this of various by-elections that took place in the period of 1900 to 1905. Interestingly, they also mentioned the Fabian Society, and the ILP. I thought it was funny. They basically dismissed the Fabians as the cult of the civil service. And then they went into detail of the opportunism of the ILP, which the ILP were doing the same thing as the SDF were, with regards to working for liberal support, where they were like, if we're allowed to stand our candidate in Bradford, we won't support, non-liberal candidates elsewhere. With reference, talking too much as usual, with reference to the left at that time, 1903, and I'm not sure if this was a secret agreement, I generally don't know, but there's a thing called the Gladstone-MacDonald Pact. That was not William Gladstone, that's Herbert Gladstone and Ramsay MacDonald. And as Adam had mentioned, the Liberals had been out of power for a number of years. I think by the time they won an election in 1906, they'd been out of power for 14 years. So they were obviously concerned that with the growing ILP, the growing Liberal Representation Committee, they were concerned that the anti-Tory vote would split at the next election, even if the Conservatives were unpopular. So an arrangement was made in 1903, where the Liberals would endorse what was known as Lib Lab candidates, and Labour would agree, or the Labour Representation Committee rather, would agree not to stand in seats where their vote could let the Tories either retain their seats or stay in. And the Early Standards obviously go into great detail of, even if they weren't aware of this pact in 1903, it was pretty obvious that the Liberals and the ILPers especially were trying to work together to trade off and, to ensure that both sides could get elected. And as Adam mentioned, 1906, there was the general election in January, and it was a landslide for Campbell Bannerman's Liberal Party. And amongst that majority was 29, I believe, Lib Lab MPs, and I think there was 20 MPs that had been voted as Labour candidates. And, you know, that's obviously that government of Campbell Bannerman, and then obviously Asquith, who succeeded Campbell Bannerman in 1908, was the beginning of, I guess, what you could call welfare capitalism in Britain. Lloyd George, as Chancellor, introduced pensions, etc. Social insurance limited, and this was obviously the thing that the party was warning against, that the Labourites, the Liberals, the radical Liberals, you know, this was their idea of radical reform, and the party obviously is 1904, 1905 is pointing to the limitations of that and what it would result in, and how meagre it actually was. I believe the pensions was like 5 shillings a week if you were actually alive to claim it. One thing I'd just like to touch upon again, because I realise talking too long, about the early standards and its relationship with other groups. As mentioned before, the party's attitude to the Second International, it is interesting that the party did make a point of translating a lot of, I guess, what you call impossibilist French literature in the standards. The Guidists, that's the people who, the group in the French Socialist Party who were organized around Gilles Guide, probably wrong pronunciation. People like Paul Lafargue, Karl Marx's son-in-law, and Charles Rapoport. These were people who the party obviously saw a certain kinship with at this time, and recognised it wasn't just ourselves alone at this point. And it's interesting that the early standards would publish these translations. Adam actually wrote a very interesting article on the party's relationship with the Guidists, which you could probably find on my blog, but it was posted somewhere else. But you know, I just want to throw that in, because obviously there's a certain kind of party mythology which kind of the party wraps itself in at times. Some members do, about how the party kind of conducted itself or how it related to other groups. And I always think it's a bit more complex than that. And I think that's one example from the Edwardian period, which I think kind of proves that. I could say other stuff, but you know, I'm sick of the sound of my own voice at this point. So I'll just stop there, and you know, if there's any questions, maybe I'll answer to the best of my ability, you know, rising out of the discussion. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Darren.